week of December 16th, 2012, this is Showbiz Sandbox episode 174, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news-making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And in New York, I'm Michael Giltz.
So, Michael, I was headed off to see The Hobbit this week, as I'm sure you did.
You were going on an adventure, yeah. As the trailer said.
Yes, and I was, you know, headed out the door, and then the mail came. And I thought, oh, well, I better get the mail first. And there in the mail was a big surprise for me. A DVD.
Ah!
yes, a DVD of the complete season of Terra Nova. Now, anybody that has listened to Showbiz Sandbox in the past knows that I recorded all of the episodes. I think six of them. All maybe there were 10 or 12 episodes of Terra Nova.
Of a not very good dinosaur show.
Right. And it was on Fox, and they were all on my TiVo. And then I guess the show got canceled, and I thought, well, I'll just delete them all. Never watched them. I watched maybe 5 episodes. And I guess somebody sent me a copy of the complete series. So thank you, Michael. That somebody was you.
You're welcome. Now you have no excuse. They sat on your TiVo for a year, which amazes me. And you never watched them, never got around to them. So they come back to you. In this day and age, TV shows never disappear. You think you missed the chance. You can see them on iTunes. You can see them on Hulu. You can see them on DVD. They'll be around forever.
That's
no
true.
No show will ever go out of print again.
Well, print. Well, you know, out of circulation.
That's an old publishing term.
Well, I would imagine that you spent your weekend at the movie theater.
I did go to the movies. Obviously there was a terrible tragedy, right as the weekend began. And as Hollywood will, they immediately wondered how this might affect business. How will this affect the opening of The Hobbit? It was a sad shooting, school shooting that, as always, the industry has to react to. You know, you don't want to be callous, but you do have to make decisions. Do they go on with movie premieres? What TV shows are they showing on television in the next few days? Will any of them seem incongruous or offensive? What do they do? So a lot of decisions had to be made over the weekend by the studios and the networks to deal with the reality of in a different environment for a few days after some tragedy like this occurs.
Right. It was the, biggest mass shooting in U.S. history, if I'm not mistaken, with 28 people dead in Newton, Connecticut. So for those of you who are just joining us on Earth, that's what we're talking about. And I guess Fox decided to cancel Sunday's brand new episodes of The Family Guy and American Dad. And
well, where they cherry picked the episodes that they thought might have some content that would be inappropriate. It wasn't that they said, we're not going to show new television. They showed new episodes of The Simpsons and something else because they thought these are fine. They
right.
looked at the shows and said, there's something here that we would regret showing in this environment, and made the decision to pull two of them.
Right. And Sci-Fi pulled an episode of Haven, a show I've never seen.
Right. Exactly. And of course, studios had premieres lined up over the weekend.
Right. And so what was canceled? So we had... Well, two were canceled, right? Jack Reacher and Parental Guidance.
I don't know. It's several days later. I mean, when is it appropriate to go on with a premiere again? What about Canada? Why are they having movie premieres? What about England? So it's a difficult question. I guess you err on the side of caution if you're a studio and you want to be sensitive. But it's not like the movies aren't going to come out. Not like people didn't get on with their lives. It's a difficult choice. You can't really win as a studio. You have an elaborate program set up to deal with your TV shows, your movies, but you got to react. You got to make choices. I don't think it was the worst shooting in U.S. history. Not that we want to rank these as number one, but I believe it was among the worst.
It certainly was. Look, the person walked into an elementary school.
No, I don't have to talk about it.
Yeah.
Can we have a tragedy-free zone?
Yeah, I think it's kind of interesting the way it has affected. I was getting text messages from all over the world that day, and I'm nowhere near Connecticut. So it's interesting the way it affects people. I think the last time where I guess I can recall Hollywood saying, well, gee, what do we do here, was after 9/11. And I remember going to the press junket for Zoolander, which was a movie that I thought was very funny, and it's become a bit of a hit on DVD. But it was a comedy, and they just didn't know how to handle it, and the film came out and bombed.
I don't know if that was because of 9/11. That's just me.
Did you see the beginning of Saturday Night Live?
No, I recorded to watch the music performances, but I typically only once or twice a year force myself to suffer through an episode of Saturday Night Live.
Oh.
And it wasn't last night. I saw Paul McCartney's fine first song, and then horrific performance of arguably the worst song he's ever written, Wonderful Christmas Time. Just a dreadful, dreadful holiday song that he wrote. And it's as dull and rote as anything he's ever done. It's so bad. Oh.
What was he trying to keep up with John Lennon there? John Lennon wrote a great Christmas song. He said, oh, I
John
can
Lennon
do it
wrote
too.
One of the best of all time. Paul wrote one of the worst. For right. a great for a person with talent. Paul McCartney has a lot of great music to his credit, but that is not one of them.
Well, to I guess, honor and remember the victims of the recent tragedy, Saturday Night Live started off with a chorus of children singing Silent Night. It was very touching, and then they kind of faded to black, faded right back up, and the kids said, live from New York, it's Saturday night. So I thought they handled it quite well and ended it in a way that said, all right, you know, we've paid our respects, we're going to have some fun now.
Were they the kids who sang on the Paul McCartney song?
Probably, yes.
What do you mean, probably?
Well, I didn't see the Paul McCartney song, but I can imagine that they probably were.
Life goes on.
Yes, and in fact, so does our show. And unfortunately, I did not write an intro to the show today, so we're going to be discussing some stuff that has to do with entertainment. I know we're going to be discussing some Hobbit stuff, that's for sure, because Michael...
And Oscar talk. We'll have a talk about the Oscars.
That's right. We're going to talk about the Oscars and the SAG Awards and the Golden Globes and critics' picks. And then, Michael, you have, I think, about 3 or 4 volumes of ebook news and whether ebooks and print books can coexist with one another. That I do know. Of course, we'll cover all the big entertainment headlines during Big Deal or Big Whoop. We're going to wind up talking about whether the studios are making movies today, whether they're in that business or whether they have somehow moved on to other businesses. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz to fill us in on the weekend's box office. I think I know what movie came in first place.
And the number one movie around the world is, of course, The Hobbit, An Unexpected Journey, shown in 2D, 3D, high frame rate 3D, high frame rate 3D IMAX, and perhaps some other formats I'm not aware of yet.
3D IMAX, just plain old 3D 20.
I said that.
Okay.
Yeah. It grossed $223 million around the world. It did better than the last Lord of the Rings movies, basically in every category. It set a December record for opening day, a December record for the weekend. It made money. $223 million. Other movies open, though. Let's get to them first, and then we'll come back to The Hobbit, because there's so much to say. It's the only one we're talking about. Number two around the world is Rise of the Guardians, the Paramount film. It grossed $27 million. It's at $190 million and counting.
That's really a disappointment, because when you think about it, here in North America, that film has only made $71 million. And for a film that cost $150 million and is a DreamWorks animation film, I think they were expecting it to do a little better than that.
And they're running out of time as far as holiday business
That's
is
right.
concerned.
Yeah.
And number three is Skyfall, the James Bond film, another $19 million. It's at $951 million worldwide. So clearly, it will be the first Bond film to gross $1 billion around the world. And number four is a tie at $17 million. It's The Twilight Saga, Breaking Dawn Part 2, and Life of Pi, the Ang Lee film, which is slowly making good business around the world. It's at $200 million and counting. And number five is Wreck-It Ralph, another animated film. It made $8 million. It's at $226 million worldwide and counting. And number six, opened basically in North America, is Lincoln, the Steven Spielberg Oscar hopeful. It's grossed $7.2 million, and it's at $107 million and counting. And number seven, the Gerard Butler film Playing for Keeps, way down at $3.2 million. Pitch Perfect is starting to open up overseas. That's the comedy about glee in college is sort of how it's pitched. That made $2.5 million. Red Dawn
was at $2.3. Was that a joke? That's how it's pitched? Pitch Perfect?
Oh, no, it wasn't a joke.
Okay.
Red Dawn is basically only open in North America, $2.3 million. It just passed the $40 million mark. And another Oscar hopeful, Silver Linings Playbook, which really has to hope for a lot of momentum from the Oscars, because it's not really a hit yet. It grossed $2 million this weekend. It's at $19 million and counting. Arguably, it's either poised to capitalize on Oscar nominations or it's petering out and will worsen its Oscar nominations because it's not doing a little bit better at the box office.
Well, it's a film that cost about $20 million, so figure $30 million with advertising and marketing. It's definitely going to make some money, but it might just break even or earn a small profit.
Sure, but it's not word of mouth hit. I mean, it's petering out at, you know, $19 million, so it's not exactly... You know, people aren't flocking to it and saying, what a wonderful film. Lincoln, on the other hand, has passed the $100 million mark. It's a hit, but not such a gaudy hit. You might not want to give it any awards.
Right.
It's a strange little balance.
Right.
But again, the only movie that matters is The Hobbit. Did you see The Hobbit?
I was going to, but then, you know, I got this Terra Nova DVD in the mail and spent the entire weekend at home watching Terra Nova.
Now, everybody is going to talk about high frame rate.
I know.
The way this film was displayed, but what they should be talking about is something entirely different. It's staring you right in the face. What is it, Sperling? What should we be talking about? It's 3D.
Oh, are you going into...
This film grossed less than half of its potential from 3D. 49% of its gross ticket sales came from 3D in North America. Well, less than half. This movie is made for 3D. This is a fantasy film from a huge franchise, from a huge director. It was created and designed and meant to be seen in 3D. It's geared towards people who are supposed to gobble 3D up. And most of the audience said, no, thank you. We do not want to see this movie in 3D. And frankly, if you look at the theater listings, you had to work hard to see this movie in 2D. It wasn't so easy. So
yeah,
that
I wonder about that.
That is a clear rejection of 3D. This is the day that 3D died. If The Hobbit cannot gross, this is just opening weekend. You got to figure that number is going to drop and drop and drop every weekend, because people who go third, fourth, and fifth time probably are not going to be paying. You know, they're not the eager fans who want to be there opening weekend. They're casual goers. So they're not going to be ponying up for $20 to see a 3D IMAX high frame rate version of The Hobbit. They're going to go see it for, I paid $18.50 to see the movie in 3D high frame rate. Good Lord. I would have much rather paid $7. Thank you.
$7 and you would have seen it in black and white with no sound and an organist?
Yes, that's exactly why they make movies in 3D, to charge you more money. That's exactly why they release a movie like The Hobbit, which was not shot in IMAX, on IMAX screens, which most of them are not even IMAX screens. It's a big ripoff. And people have wised, and they've said, no, thank you. If they don't go see The Hobbit in 3D, what the heck are they going to go see 3D for? People do not want to see movies in 3D. They are rejecting it. If this movie cannot even break 50% on opening weekend, the end is nigh on 3D.
Well, 60% overseas is what it is.
That's because overseas, they're where we were two or three years ago. Two or three years ago, we saw movies opening to 60% all the time. But the novelty wore off. People said, this sucks. I've seen how many movies in 3D? 30 in the last 2 years? None of them matter to be seen in 3D. Coraline was well done in 3D. That had an up. Had a certain emotional context that sort of was nicely done in the 3D. Everything else, it was fine. The 3D in The Hobbit was good. It worked. It was effective. But did it add anything creatively or emotionally to the movie? Not to me. Do I want to see it in 3D? No. My friends took their glasses off and said, if I never see another movie in 3D, I'll be glad. That's what people, nobody wants to pay all this money to see movies in 3D. Creatively, almost none of them matter in 3D. Life of Pi does not matter in 3D. None of them do. It's just a waste of money. People don't want to spend the extra money. Movies are expensive enough as it is.
Well, let me ask you this. If it didn't cost extra money, would it be okay?
They wouldn't make them. Most of them they wouldn't make. Exactly. If they weren't allowed to charge extra money, 90% of the movies released in 3D would not be shown in 3D. Then it would only be the movies where the filmmaker really cared, like The Hobbit or Life of Pi or Coraline, where they probably said, I really want to shoot this in 3D for various reasons. But it would be four or five movies a year rather than every movie every other week. Every animated film made in Hollywood is in 3D now. Why? No good reason.
Well, I can tell. Well, actually, there is a good reason.
Kids hate 3D.
Well, no,
kids,
but there's a good reason why you can make an
it's
animated
easier.
Film. Yeah, it, because
easier.
All the elements are there, and it's just
right.
easier
it's
to
easier,
do.
It's cheaper, and they can charge extra. But kids hate it. Families hate it. And creatively, there's no reason for it except to make more money. So they're making the movie-going experience miserable for people. They're charging extra. Kids hate the glasses. And everybody's unhappy. Way to go, Hollywood.
Well, yeah, and I kind of wonder, because I know my kids wanted to see Rise of the Guardians, but they specifically requested not to see it in 3D. I mean, they now know what 3D is, and that means you have to wear the glasses. They requested not to see it in 3D. I wonder if the reason that a movie like The Hobbit is earning 50% of its gross in North America from 2D showings is because families are going to see it, and they're not wanting to either A, pay extra, or B, the kids just don't like 3D. So the family says, all right, even though the mother or father might want to go see 3D, they're going to go see it in 2D.
Well, and that's the gross. Ticket sales were probably 55% in 2D because I paid $18.50. People in the Heartland paid $7.50 to see this movie in 2D.
Well, let me ask you this.
I paid $18.50. That's 2.5 times what they paid. And that's the gross was 49% in 3D. So in fact, ticket sales, it's probably more like 55%, if not even 60%. That's a huge rejection of 3D.
Well, most films that are being released in 3D right now, the gross is usually about 50% 3D.
That's the start,
right.
Yeah.
Now, let me ask you this. Did you see it in IMAX?
No, it's not shot in IMAX.
Okay, because
why the hell would I pay extra to see it in IMAX?
What
idiot would pay to see it in IMAX? It's a bad movie-going experience.
Wait a second, you could be insulting some of our listeners because...
They know by now that I think they're foolish if they pay extra to see a movie in a format it was not shot in, and which is not ideal for viewing a movie.
Well, in North America alone, because that's the only territory for which we have numbers, the film made $10.1 million, or 12% of the $84 million it made over the weekend.
That's part of the 3D gross, because almost all the IMAX screenings were in 3D.
Right, and they're not announcing or making public, at least Warner Brothers isn't providing a breakdown of, you know, how much a high frame rate screen made. And
That's a mixture of, I mean, I don't think any 2D was shown in high frame rate, right?
I don't believe so, although... Just to give you some sense, IMAX is reporting high frame rate, and they say that their per screen average was $44,000 per screen over the weekend for a high frame rate 3D IMAX showing, whereas their 3D IMAX showings were $31,000 per
screen. The preferred choice for people seeing the deluxe version was high frame rate.
Right. Now, what did you think
of it? They wanted to see it in high frame rate. But before we get to high frame rate, do you think the studios woke up and said, oh my God, even this movie cannot break 50% in gross on 3D. Do you think that they are waking up and saying, wow, that is, to me, is a huge headline. That to me is a wake up call, a slap in the face to tell them this is not working. Why are you spending tens of millions of dollars to release movies in a format people don't want to see? Why are you doing that?
No, I don't think so. I think the high frame rate was the biggest.
What does it
issue.
Have to be? 40%? 30%?
Yeah,
20%?
When it starts to get to 30%.
Well, why 40%? If vast majority of people on opening weekend reject your movie in the format you spent tens of millions of dollars to put it in, why wouldn't you wake up then?
Because right now they're going where the creatives want to go, and the creatives want to do it in 3D. You know, both Cameron.
Don't count Cameron and Jackson as creatives. Not everybody wants to shoot every film in 3D. Most filmmakers do not want to shoot their dramas in 3D.
No, and that's why
you
see
confuse two guys with Hollywood. There's two people pushing 3D, James Cameron, essentially, and now maybe Peter Jackson. Nobody else is going crazy for 3D. I mean, Robert Zemeckis for a few years pushed horrific rotoscoping on his animated film.
It's not rotoscoping, it's motion capture. But yes.
It's the same, yeah, but it's a weird thing. Right, don't confuse them with all of Hollywood.
No, but I think the bigger element here, the bigger factor here is the high frame rate. Everybody's looking at high frame rate for this particular film. You know, 3D, if it continues to decline, yes, you'll definitely see the studios kind of changing some of their behaviors. But right now, the behavior that they would change is high frame rate, in my opinion.
But if they think that this film was shown, I don't know whether it was a technical thing or what, but only 2D was in regular format. You could not see high frame rate in 2D, right? So they charged extra for high frame rate. Do they think this is another thing that we want to pay extra for? Because no, thank you. You want to shoot it in high frame rate or on digital or on film? I don't care. I'm paying to see a movie. No, you never talk to me about the budget or color or black and white. Those are creative decisions. 48 frames per second, 60 frames per second, film, high def. These are artistic, creative choices. They should not affect my ticket price. Do it, shoot it whatever the way you want, but don't ask me to pay extra for it. If you think you're going to get to, you know, bring in higher ticket prices because it's shot in a high frame rate, you're out of your mind.
No, well, you know, a higher...
That's what they think. They're charging extra for high frame rate.
But wait a second.
Like
they're not
they
charging
made the switch
extra...
from cassettes to CDs. They said, guess what? We're going to charge you a lot extra.
I don't know one exhibitor that is charging extra for high frame rate. However, because...
It's only in high frame rate 3D. Of course it's extra.
Well, it's the 3D that you're paying for, not the high frame rate.
Malarkey.
Well, let me ask you this. Can you find a screening that is in 3D, 24 frames per second?
So no. They weren't making it available.
That costs, well, they must have been, Michael, because there's only 400 screens in the country that are showing it in high frame rate. So my question is, can you find a theater that is showing it in both high frame rate and not high frame rate that has a differing cost between the high frame rate version and the non-high
frame rate?
So
you don't think the
reading.
Studios think this is a little extra thing that they can charge extra for?
No, because they already know they right. kind of shot themselves already with 3D. There's no way they can charge
extra. Well, they don't need glasses. There's no need. I mean, they have a technological change they got to make, but basically they're ready for high frame rate already, right?
Well, I hesitate to say yes. They have to make, as you say, a technological change. Not every theater is going to be capable of making that change. Only projectors from the last year or two can make that change. But yes, they can kind of get a firmware upgrade and maybe a little bit of a hardware upgrade to get there. Certainly all projectors and servers, digital cinema projectors and servers being sold, henceforth, will be capable of high frame rate.
Okay, so it's not a backdoor attempt to raise prices again.
No. 3D, they know that they can't, after 3D and the pushback on 3D, they know they can't go down that road.
But let me see it in 2D. Yeah.
Yeah, well, that's a different story entirely. And that has to do with, I think, more along, exhibitors. Believe me, if exhibitors saw that more people would show up to their movie theaters if they showed the 2D version, they would throw the 3D version right out.
Well, they already did. Most people went to see the 2D version. All the hoopla was for the 3D and the high frame rate, and most people went to see it in 2D. They already did. 55% of tickets sold were for 2D. No,
well, 55. Okay, well, I'd have
to... Yeah, I'm estimating since the gross of 3D, which is wildly, extravagantly higher price than 2D, you can pay $12 to see the movie in 2D in New York. You pay over $20 to see it in IMAX 3D high frame rate. That's almost double the price. So it has to be at least 55% of tickets sold were for 2D, at least. So people have already said, I don't want to see the damn 3D.
Okay, well, let me...
So why aren't they throwing 3D out?
Because...
You just said they throw it out.
Because why would you throw away 50% of your gross? Why would you lower 50% of your gross?
Why would you make it harder for people to see the movie the way you want? Because when people go to a movie and they're annoyed, and when they end the film and take off the glasses and go, God, I hate 3D. That's not an experience that makes them want to return to the movies.
Well, I'd be interested to see the distributor that says, you know what, we're going to try an experiment. This would have been a 3D film, and we would have expected, hypothetical, 1.4 million tickets sold over the weekend. Let's not release it in 3D. Let's release it in 2D and see if we can sell 1.8 million tickets over the weekend. I highly doubt somebody.
You're confusing things. People want to see a movie. It doesn't mean that they're going to necessarily. People, you're saying people stayed home. That's not the case. The case is you want to give them an option. You want to make it not hard for them. You don't want to charge them extra. But if they keep rejecting a format, why would you keep spending tens of millions of dollars to release it in that format? Doesn't mean an extra 500,000 people are going to show up to the movies, but it does mean they might have a good time and enjoy themselves and come back next time. Families with kids don't dread going to family films, having to decide whether to do 2D or 3D and this and that and the other thing. It's a pain in the neck.
Well, let me ask. I'm going to move us along a little bit
here. Did you see for high frame rate?
I've seen it numerous...
No. Did you see The Hobbit in the high frame rate?
I have seen it in...
No, well, you didn't sit down and see the film.
I didn't sit down and watch the entire film. No, I have seen portions of The Hobbit in high frame rate, yes.
Yeah, but you didn't get the chance to sink into it and spend 2.5 hours in it. Okay.
No. And what did you think of it?
I didn't hate it as much as I thought I would.
Okay. Most of the critics, just abhorred it.
Yes. I think it's akin to when television switched to high def.
And you're absolutely right about that. I think
when local TV stations switched to high def, people might remember the anchors, suddenly you could see the makeup on their face, the pancake makeup, the desks you could tell were just flimsy cardboard, the backdrops looked fake. Everything looked bad because you could see it better. And they had to adjust and learn how to relight a set, build sets better, do makeup differently. They had to really learn and adjust how to present stuff because the high frame rate, or in that case, high def television, captured things that used to be invisible. You got to relearn your techniques. And I think that's what we saw with this movie. I didn't like it. I wasn't like a bring on high frame rate, but I didn't hate it. And I did think that you might see artists adapt and be able to present scenes that would be even more convincing and real once they learn what the flaws and strengths and minuses are of high frame rate.
Yeah, I'm surprised that they let Peter Jackson do this on a $500 million budget, that they're going to take this kind of risk. Although he did only go to 48 frames per second rather than 60, which would have been a lot harder to go back to 24. So there are screenings at 24 frames per second. And frankly, I would prefer to see that. And every critic that I read said the same thing, that it is not, they call it the soap opera effect, where it looks like a soap opera or plasticky. And you're absolutely right, Michael. That is exactly what's happening here in regards to the high definition transition, is that all of a sudden we can see more detail. And by seeing more detail, it takes us out of the film because we're looking at Gandalf's staff and going, wow, that looks really like a piece of cardboard. It doesn't look like, an ornate wooden sculpture anymore. It looks fake. And by looking fake, it takes us out of the film. It doesn't absorb, it doesn't immerse us in the film any more so than it would at 24 frames per second.
But that doesn't mean it's bad any more than high def is bad, which is not standard. You just have to learn how to build your sets better and do makeup differently and all that sort of stuff.
Absolutely right. Yes.
I don't know that it's the future. I'm not eager for it. It did make the 3D, I think, work more effectively. I think the high frame rate somehow worked better with the 3D.
Well,
I don't know why that would be.
There's less eye strain, that's why. But
okay.
Yes.
It did have a flat video look. Everybody I was with hated it. You know, they were all looking, one is an editor, others are filmmakers or casting agents. They're all people in the industry, and they were all, you know, interested looking at it, and they were all very negative on it. They did not like it. They thought it looked cheap and fake. It certainly looked like video, what we're used to as the aesthetic of video.
Well, and it was shot on video. I mean, it was shot in digital video, very high-end digital video, but still video.
But I'm not...
You're not sold. You're not convinced.
I was much less anti-high frame rate than I thought I would be. I was always aware of it. And the one thing that struck me was that it was a major change. It wasn't like some little thing that they tweaked that whatever. It was like the jump from VHS to DVD. Any idiot could see that and know, wow, I'm looking at something different.
Right.
You know, whether they like it or not. That's another comparison. When you went from cassettes and LPs to compact discs, anybody could tell there was a lot more sound quality there. Anybody could tell that there was a lot more detail. But they didn't always do a good job of remastering the old albums and putting them on CDs. So it's a new technique that you have to learn. How to make albums sound good on compact disc was a technique. It took them several years to get it right.
Right.
And even after that, you would still sometimes hear about, oh, that album's poorly mastered. Nowadays, you would never hear about that. It would be silly. It's been 20 plus years, 30 years. But it was a learning curve. Movies, whether it's worth that learning curve, I don't know. But I was not as aghast and annoyed by it as I thought it would be.
Well, let me ask you this. Uh-huh. Did you like the movie?
Oh, God.
Because a lot of critics did not like the movie.
Well, I was prepared not to like. I was prepared not to love it. The Lord of the Rings, each film was one of my favorites of the year. I think as a trilogy, I think it's one of the great accomplishments in film, really. Almost no epic fantasy films are made. And if they are, they're like Willow. They suck. And this was actually
wow,
a terrific...
you're pulling one out of the 80s. Okay, go ahead. Yeah,
this was a tremendous trilogy. I loved it. I could list you moment by moment the few little details I don't like in each film. I don't like this. I don't like that. I don't like Galadriel in this scene. I don't like this. I don't like that. You know,
I don't like the 500 endings of the Return of the King.
Sure, sure. I hear you. But as a work of art, I really love it. I think it's a tremendous accomplishment. So when all these negative reviews were coming, I'm like, all right, maybe I'm just going to like it. They're not fans like I am. They're not crazy fans. It'll be okay. You know, maybe it'll be slow starter, just like the Return of the King was a slow ender, and the middle two will be better. I mean, this is not Phantom Menace bad, but it is a bad film. It is almost shocking how much of a less good movie it is than The Lord of the Rings. It is a bad movie. The squandered opportunities, the bad creative choices as far as acting and screenwriting are endless. I'd have to have the DVD here and go write them down. There are so many of them. It's just, it's shocking. It's like it's mechanical. It's just unbelievable how much of a drop it is in quality. It's closer to Tintin than it is to The Lord of the Rings.
Well, you know, it's interesting because I have a theory on directors like Peter Jackson and like, frankly, Quentin Tarantino, although he manages to pull things off every now and again. They kind of hit this level where nobody says no to them. And I think Peter Jackson reached that with King Kong, and it just went on and on and on, and it was way too long. And you know, nobody said no. And I think I was really afraid of that when Peter Jackson decided to take over for Guillermo del Toro on The Hobbit.
Guillermo del Toro left.
Well, yeah, he left. But that he decided to step in and direct, and I thought, oh, you know what's going to happen is there's like the auteur has now arrived, and nobody's going to say no, and it's going to actually be very disappointing. And sure enough, that's exactly what you're saying.
Yeah. Well, artistic freedom can be a dangerous thing. Having a major studio there to check you and say, no, we need to, you know, no, two films is enough. $500 million is enough to spend on the budget, et cetera. Yeah, you're right. That the artistic freedom can be dangerous. But, well, you know, what are you going to do? It's very, very disappointing, though, I have to say.
Well, some films that people aren't disappointed in from this
and
past...
And now I know why it's not on the best of the year list and why it's not on any talk among Oscar and Golden Globes and all that stuff.
Well, right, and I kind of mentioned that last week, that since it wasn't being mentioned frequently or at all in any of these lists does not, it's not a very good sign that it's going to be either up for awards or is a very good film. And sure enough, Golden Globe nominations were announced last week. SAG Award nominations were announced last week. Do you want to go through some of them?
Absolutely.
Okay, so which one do you want to do first?
Well, the Golden Globes and the SAG are the two big ones. We had some other. The AFI came out with their list, the Critics' Choice Awards or something.
Yes.
They came out with their list. We've got links to them in the show notes. But the two signal ones are Golden Globes, which is a pretty good precursor to the Oscars. I think today it's almost because they try to predict the Oscars. They want famous movie stars to come to their show, and they also want to be a predictor of the Oscars. So I think they're now in a position where they try and pick movies that they think Oscar will like. I don't think that they're influencing the Oscars so much as trying to imitate the Oscars.
Well, right. And they've gotten criticized in the past for, like, giving Johnny Depp a Best Actor nominee for his role in The Tourist, a film which the year following he admitted, I didn't even see that movie.
Yeah, they've had some groaners in the acting categories because they want famous actors there.
That's
but
right.
They are trying to pick mainstream Oscar movies.
And this case, we should say, is the Hollywood Foreign Press Association.
Yes. A group of, I don't know how many people, 50, 100?
There's, I think, 95 now, 96, somewhere in there.
God bless them. I'm from Bermuda. I should get a membership card. But they have 10 films, 5 comedies or musicals, and 5 dramas. And I think this 10 list is pretty close to what we'll see at the Oscars. You have The Best Exotic Marigold Hotel, Les Mis, Moonrise Kingdom, Silver Linings Playbook, Argo, Django Unchained, Life of Pi, Lincoln, Zero Dark Thirty, and a bit of a ringer in here, Salmon Fishing in the Yemen, which is a film starring Ewan McGregor. My brother liked it, and I have it on DVD, but I haven't watched it yet.
Well, yeah, I mean, it was a film that I guess played where? It played at Toronto 2 years ago, right?
Something like that, yeah.
And came out in 2012. You know, makes me want to go
drama.
See it.
So there you go. So those are the 10 films that they have singled out. And then you can see the acting categories. Surprises. Well, Daniel Day-Lewis got a nomination for Best Actor in Lincoln. Big surprise. You know, Richard Gere for Arbitrage, John Hawkes for The Sessions, Joaquin Phoenix for The Master, and Denzel Washington for Flight. Would I be surprised if that was the list of, it's close to the list for the Oscars. I doubt Richard Gere. I do think the SAG, they singled out Jack Black for his performance in Bernie, which I actually love. So I think he might sneak in there, but you're probably looking at 4 or 5 of the Best Actor nominees. Same thing for the women. Jessica Chastain for Zero Dark Thirty, Marion Cotillard for Rust and Bone, Helen Mirren for Hitchcock, Naomi Watts for The Impossible, and Rachel Weisz for The Deep Blue Sea. I imagine 3 of those at least will probably be on the Oscar list.
Well, and I wonder, I guess it's Best Motion Picture Musical or Comedy, which is why Les Mis wound up there, but... P.T. Anderson, Paul Thomas Anderson, not in the Best Director category, nor is, now I'm forgetting his name, but the director of Les Mis.
Tom Hooper?
Thank you, yes.
I keep saying Toby Hooper, but that would be a very different film.
Right, and that's...
He's the horror director.
I almost said the same thing. That's why I was like, I better not say that, because I know it's not Toby Hooper.
Yeah, the Globes liked The Master. They gave it a lot of acting nominations. Joaquin Phoenix and...
Amy Adams...
And Philip Seymour Hoffman, I believe, right, for supporting.
Yes, I believe so.
Or was that in the SAG? I mean, they all tend to blur after a little while because they're very similar films. Amy Adams, Philip Seymour Hoffman got nominated for Best Supporting Actor, so they liked the movie. They just didn't give it Best Picture or Director. I guess Salmon Fishing in the Yemen edged it out.
Right, and you know, one film that you have not heard us mention here, you know what it is?
What?
Beast of the Southern Wild.
Well, that's no stars, so the Globes are not interested in that movie. They don't want to talk about that movie. And SAG, of course, it's not a SAG film, so it's not eligible.
That's right. Well, that I expected, but...
So that's why Beast of the Southern Wild isn't anywhere on here. Not that it will necessarily be. It's a long shot for the Oscars, but it would be a Cinderella story if it got a nomination. So then if you look at SAG, those are the main nominations for the Golden Globes. So when you look at SAG, you see their outstanding performance by a cast. That's essentially their Best Picture nominee. If you look at the 5 movies, you can see they like films with big casts and a lot of actors in them. If you've got 2 people in a room, SAG is probably not excited by that.
So what you're saying is my dinner with Andre was not on this list.
That's right. They want to see a lot of actors getting work. So their picks for Best Picture are Silver Linings Playbook, which I'm actually, was that in the Best Comedy?
Yes, it was.
Okay. So Silver Linings Playbook. Yeah, they really do blur. Lincoln, Les Mis, Argo, which is probably the one example that doesn't quite fit that formula, and The Best Exotic Marigold Hotel. 4 out of 5 of those have a lot of name actors and a lot of roles. And you can see why they would appeal to the SAG voter. Argo, arguably, it's about an actor becoming a director, Ben Affleck, and having a wonderful triumph. And I think they love that as well. They love it when actors turn directors.
Yeah, you know, one person who is maybe overlooked, maybe not, I don't know. Did you see The Sessions?
Not yet.
Helen Hunt was in that film, and she plays the sex surrogate. And she is, you know, John Hawks, who plays the main character, is, you know, being nominated for everything. But Helen Hunt, completely overlooked. And maybe that's right. I don't know. I mean, certainly you remember John Hawks' performance more than Helen Hunt's, but she was there as well. Oh, and you know what? I take that back. SAG Award, outstanding performance by a female actor in a supporting role, Helen Hunt, The Sessions.
And I was so looking forward to saying that once you were done with your rant.
Oh,
but,
brother.
You know, that's a movie like Silver Linings Playbook, which has not had a lot of momentum at the box office. It's a film that came out, sort of petered out. It's made its money. It's sort of done. There's not a ton of critical support for it. So they are flashy acting performances. They could get nominations for the Oscars. She's certainly an Oscar favorite. His would be a breakthrough performance for him as far as the Oscars, though he was on Deadwood. He was a very good actor. But, you know, it doesn't have a ton of momentum, so it really needs these awards to help reignite it at the box office and then bring the attention of Oscars to it. But if you want to see Helen Hunt in a movie about a woman having sex with a man who's physically challenged, you might also want to see The Water Dance. It's a film from the 80s.
Oh, that is a great movie with Eric Stoltz.
Eric Stoltz and Wesley Snipes, arguably his best performance. A very good movie by Neil Jimenez, and I think it was co-directed by two people. But it's a lovely indie film, terrific score, a very nice, solid, strong movie. It just came out on DVD again. So if you're interested, check that out.
Yeah, 1992.
Oh, 92, forgive me.
Yeah, and you're absolutely right. It was written by Neil Jimenez, and it was directed by Neil Jimenez and Michael Steinberg.
Oh, there you go. I think I even interviewed Neil Jimenez or somebody for that film. I really liked it.
It was a great, great movie.
Yes, it was on my best of that year list. And perhaps on the best of the year list, when I see it, will be Five Broken Cameras. That's a documentary. It's on the long list for the Oscar nominees. It's one of the movies that could potentially be named one of the 5 best documentaries of the year. They're hoping to get on that short list. It premiered at Film Forum in May. It's been playing all over the country. Now, of course, they're an Oscar hopeful because they made that list of nominees that are potential to be, you know, make the cut. And now they're having screenings around the country. It's coming out on DVD in early 2013. And here's a new wrinkle, a new window that they've thrown into the mix. They want Oscar voters to see it. They want to get attention for the movie. So they're putting it out right now on Hulu Plus.
Yeah, I mean, I've noticed a lot of the documentaries and films are released on Hulu Plus. The indie films, not major studio fare.
Do you mean the ones on the Oscar list, or do you just mean all documentary films in general tend to appear on Hulu Plus?
I mean that documentary films that are being released theatrically often appear on Hulu Plus, and they appear on iTunes as well.
Mm-hmm. So it's just it's easy for them to get on there. They get on there. Why not? They've got deals, or,
well, you know, when you have Morgan Spurlock or whoever it is, the filmmaker, or, you know, there are newspaper articles or television pieces or radio news about a particular film. You want people to be able to see it who don't have access to it in a theater. So if you're in Kansas City, you may not have Five Broken Cameras showing at a Film Forum type theater.
You don't.
So there you go. There's a place where you might want to have somebody in Kansas City willing to pay $8 to see the film. You might want to give them access to do so.
Well, that's why you have video on demand, and that's why films get released in New York and LA by the IFC, and then they're on video on demand all over the country.
Correct. Yes.
So we see that a lot for indie films, but I'm wondering specifically about Hulu Plus. Do they make it easy for filmmakers to place their content on that channel?
I don't know. I have no idea. I think that basically you've got a number of companies out there that are helping, like CD Baby helps musicians get onto iTunes, their music onto iTunes. There are a number of companies out there that help filmmakers get their films onto iTunes and all of these VOD and alternative.
It's a lot of work because there's a ton of outlets. So
they don't all accept films directly from filmmakers. Because
About Hulu Plus. Why you noted that they have a lot of documentary films. They must have some outreach or some way that they make it easier for filmmakers to get their movies on there. Unless you're just talking about the big high visibility films. I mean, Morgan Spurlock is going to get his film everywhere.
Right. No, I'm talking about films where I'm like, oh, that's interesting. I didn't know that that
film. I just thought this was an interesting new wrinkle in the Oscar campaign. You want your documentary film to get attention. Make sure it's as easy as possible for everyone to see it. Put it on Hulu Plus.
Exactly.
Even before it's out, it's still in theaters. And, you know, before it comes out on DVD.
Well, could you write an ebook about it?
Yes, you could. I'm sure. Why not?
Well, a blog called Book Patrol posted an infographic about ebooks recently. And this is ebooks versus print, that put a happy spin on whether ebooks and print would fight to the death or live happily ever after arm in arm. And I know this is a subject that you like, Michael. So the industry, I'm sorry?
Well, it sort of drove me nuts because it was an infographic passed along by an industry paper, Publishers Weekly, and it sort of put the most positive spin imaginable on these changes whirling the publishing industry. And it did so with sort of poor analysis of statistics that just kind of drove me. I'm like, no, that's not what it says at all. It just drove me nuts that it was sort of a poorly done, misleading infographic about all these changes and ebooks versus print. So
what was
kind of ruffled by feathers.
Well, it was the industry trade paper, Publishers Weekly, that linked to it as a positive spin on the most traumatic change roiling the industry in decades and calming people down and giving them hope that not so much is changing after all. So I can already tell, Michael, you want to tear it to shreds, so take it away.
Well, why don't you start off with what the infographic said? We've got a couple items here about what they were arguing and what the statistics they proffered.
Well, one of the things that may be the fiction is that will e-readers really edge out printed books? And so far, 1 in 10 people with e-readers have abandoned print entirely. But people with e-readers usually just read more of both. People without e-readers read an average of 15 books last year. And although I guess I'm bringing that average down. People with e-readers read an average of 24 books per year. And in fact, of those who read e-books in the past 12 months, 88% also read a printed book.
Even as you read that, you can sort of see how some of that seems misleading or confusing or doesn't make sense. As they said, people without e-readers read an average of 15 books last year. Well, I wish that were true, but it's certainly not. Maybe they mean a median number or something, but there's no way the average person reads 15 books. I may read 60 or 70, but if you looked at most people, they read probably less than 10 books a year. And that's not bad. I mean, it's a book a month. You know, people have lives and jobs. But I'm sure the majority of Americans read less than 10 books a year. So that statistic is a little misleading already. It's probably a question of confusing median and average and things like that. And what is the most telling and indicative for reading patterns in the country? Then they say, well, even if you have an e-reader, you're still reading a printed book. Well, of course you are, because most books are not available as e-readers. So
they're pointing out the obvious.
Right. And of course, there are books that you can't, you know, read on an e-reader, like a graphic novel. You know, it doesn't work on most things. It might work on some tablets, but most Kindles and most e-readers are not good for reading a graphic novel or a photo-driven book or 90% of the books throughout history are not available as an e-book. So therefore, if you want to read them, you have no choice. You have to read a printed book. So if you're a person who loves books and you have an e-reader and you read a lot, it's not telling to say they also read a printed book.
Well, okay.
So, Well,
I don't know whether it's fact or fiction, you tell us. The youngest readers, print books will still win out. 9% of people think ebooks are better for reading with kids, but 81% say print books are better. So what's the fact here? Is that true?
The fact is that 10% of people apparently couldn't answer the question. So that's a little unusual. But obviously, if you're reading to children, you're probably reading a picture book. And again, picture books are essentially unavailable on e-readers. There are some picture books on tablets. You can't use them on an e-reader, obviously, like the Kindle. Most Nooks are not good for it. Picture books just are not, they don't transfer yet. They will in a few years. We'll have Dr. Seuss and everybody else readily available on ebooks. And when they are, I can't imagine once you have tablets and color tablets and can display them properly, I'm sure they'll be just as good for reading picture books as, you know, as the picture book is in print edition. But right now, if you want to read your kid a picture book, you can't grab your Kindle.
But what about this statement here that print books might be easier to read and that people reading on iPads read 6.2% slower than print? And on Kindle's 10.7% slower than print. Is that true?
I have no idea. They have a link for every fact that they quote here in statistic. Some of them I tried to track down and figure out the original study and source. That sounds bizarre to me. I mean, I think basically you could say that, you know, the ink technology for the Kindle and for the other e-readers has improved dramatically in the last 2 or 3 years. So if you're looking at all readers ever made and how easy it is to read, it might be a little worse in the past. But if you buy a new e-reader today from Kindle or a tablet, it's a lot easier to read. Also, iPads and other tablets were huge. They were heavy and bulky. You needed two hands to read a book. It was a lot bulkier and harder to read, like in bed. So if you're looking at all those examples, the screen quality, the heaviness of the device, that may have meant in the past it was harder to read. But in fact, I think now it's easier and quicker to read on a Kindle or on another tablet device. Changing pages is a lot easier. The screen quality is so much better that I think in the future, it would be bizarre if they weren't at least equivalent, if not a lot easier to read a Kindle.
Well, then what about this next bit here, that real libraries are still, you know, they're tough to beat, and that while only 25% of people under 30 use e-readers, 60% of people aged 16 to 29 still frequent libraries. True or not true?
Well, here's another bit of misdirection. They compared one set of people, which is everyone under 30, which includes newborns, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8-year-olds. Then they compared that to a group of 16 to 29-year-olds. Well, you say, well, all right, only 25% of people under 30 use e-readers. Yes, my 2-year-old does not use a Kindle. That's true. So that's a little misleading. And then they say 60% of people aged 16 to 29 still frequent libraries. Well,
that's because they're in school.
They're in school. Not only do they go to libraries, they're probably forced to go to libraries. So again, that's just a stupid comparison between different age groups and the fact that you have students in high school and college who probably have to go to the library. So again, a pretty stupid comparison.
Well, now here they have another one. They say that at any age, no one is ready to give up print. And over the course of a year, 17% of American adults had read an ebook, 11% had listened to an audiobook, but that 72% had read a printed book. So those are those facts that where they're saying, you see, 72%, nobody wants to give up the print.
Again, their own statistics seem to say something different. 72% of people in the last year read a printed book. That means, if you look at that single statistic they provided, that 28% of people did not read a printed book. And they say no one's going to give up print, except 28% of Americans already did, either because they don't read at all, or they've made the entire switch to ebook. So, you know, it's not true.
Okay, so then finally, I guess, I don't know if this is the final one, but they're saying here that, you know, who's going to win this battle between, you know, ebooks versus print? They say, actually, you know, when you look at it, nobody, because you've got, you know, if you're reading with a child, print trounces ebooks, 81% to 9% in their poll. Sharing books with others, print trounces ebooks, 69% to 25%. Reading books in bed, that's essentially tied, with ebooks preferred 45% to 43% over print. And having a wide selection of books to choose from, well, ebooks are preferred there as well, 53% to 35%. Reading books while traveling or commuting, again, it's ebooks preferred, 73% to 19%. And then being able to get a book quickly, well, of course, ebooks win out, 83% to 13% in their poll.
Again, here's another fascinating thing where they say, no, don't worry, they're going to coexist because they're both great at different stuff. And they choose six categories, and four of them, ebooks win handily.
Yeah, I know.
Well, three of them, they trounce. And I mean, it's like, well, you've just told us that ebooks are winning. And when you look at the first category, reading with a child, we know why. I've explained why picture books are not a factor in ebooks yet, but they will be. Sharing books with others is essentially impossible with ebooks by law. So that will improve, I think, once that becomes possible. Or it might be the one area where print trounces ebooks for years to come. But in five of the six categories, ebooks are already winning or absolutely going to close the gap dramatically. So therefore, ebooks are already preferred than print books by their own categories and their own statistics.
Well, so then, you know, what's the big
the message? The takeaway, the message is, you know, don't ignore reality when dealing with changes in your industry. You know? You can't put your head in the sand and don't trust something if it tells you, oh, everything's going to be okay. It's not really that big a deal. Look at statistics, question them, think about what they're actually saying. Don't have them tell you, oh, this says this is good. You know, look at what it's actually saying and try to think for yourself, because it's not true. I mean, things are changing in book world fast. CDs are dead. Movie theaters aren't showing physical prints of film much longer. Cable channels are drawing huge audiences away from network TV. Landlines are disappearing from homes, and print is being supplanted by ebooks in almost every way you measure it. Whatever industry you're in, you cannot succeed by ignoring reality.
Yeah, so what you're saying then is, you know, the ebook is kind of a big deal.
It's
a big deal, because it is time for Big Deal or Big Whoop, our weekly segment, where we discuss the top headlines in entertainment and tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense. Our first story, well, let me ask you, Michael, how fast is your internet service provider?
I don't know.
Well, Netflix can tell you. Their 30 million members stream some 1 billion hours of video a month, so they've got a pretty good idea of who is fast and who is not. As of mid-December, they're starting to display a monthly chart showing all the major ISPs, at least in North America, and how they rank compared to each other and the actual average speed for Netflix streams. The results? Pretty remarkable when you think about it. Google Fiber is way ahead at number one with 2.55 megabits per second, and AT&T Mobile is way at the bottom with a 0.48 megabit per second, and you do not want to watch Avatar on AT&T Mobile. I guess that's the long and short of it there. Verizon Fios is number two, Comcast number three, Charter is number four, and Cablevision is number five. You know, we'll link to the entire chart so you can see how your provider fares. Michael, is this a big deal or a big whoop?
Well, I think it's a big deal because information is power. Once there's a list and people can see a valid comparison, I think this is a great comparison. Streaming video is a great measurement for how well service providers are doing. And it's not their stated thing or their maximum offering that they have. It's actual real-world usage of these service providers when people are watching streaming video from Netflix. So it's a great chart. And it has not just rankings, but specific, you know, bits, megabits per second information. So you can see Google Fiber's number one and how far ahead it is of Verizon Fios and how far they ahead are from Comcast. So I think with this out there and people paying attention to it, that would affect what service provider I used if I had an option. That would make me want to complain and say, why aren't you doing a better job? So I think that's great. My service provider is Time Warner. They're at number seven. So right. That makes me angry.
Well, you know, but at the same time, they're at 2.12 megabit per second and Google Fiber is at 2.55 megabit per second. So it's not that far off.
That's 20% better, A.
Okay, well, my you know, my ISP.
Do you want your internet to be 20% faster? I do.
Well, I guess when you put it that way.
Well, yes, you can't get you got to remember statistics, numbers, percentages. Make sure you convert them and think about what they actually mean. They're 20% faster. That's a lot faster.
You know, you always could have gotten this kind of information at speedtest.net.
Most people haven't heard of that. I think Netflix is so well known. I think this chart and publishing it every month. Does speedtest.net do it all the time and regularly? And
yeah, they do it live, but then again, they don't have 30 million members.
Right. I think the weight of Netflix and the attention it will bring, I hopefully think it will, wake people up. But I was a little surprised that Google Fiber, which is only in like one city, right?
Kansas City, yeah.
Right. I'm surprised it wasn't faster.
Well, again, they're taking average speeds. And they're also taking average speeds from Netflix's, data centers. So I'm sure it's faster for certain things.
Well, video streaming is what you want it to be fast for, though, as such, right?
True, yeah.
Yeah, I'm just a little surprised it wasn't, like 10 times faster than the others. But anyway.
In any case, moving on to L.A. Reid. Record label mogul L.A. Reid says he is leaving TV, the TV singing competition, The X Factor, after its current season, which, by the way, ends this week. Reid said it was time to refocus on his label and his artists, and besides the fact, Simon doesn't want me here anymore. Anyway.
No, that's not true.
I'm kidding.
Oh, okay.
It leaves Simon Cowell, Britney Spears, and Demi Lovato as judges on the show, which is, it's doing fine for Fox, but is far from the blockbusters that, say, The Voice and American Idol are. Cowell's X Factor in the UK is also still very strong, but notably down in the ratings the last two seasons since Cowell stepped down as a judge from them to focus on the U.S. launch of X Factor. Is Reid's departure a big deal or a big whoop, Michael?
Well, I guess it's a big whoop because these days they're just rotating chairs. You had judges on American Idol for like 10 years before there was any change. And now on all these other shows, they're just changing all the time, it feels like. And when you get a good mix, you don't want to mess it up. I think L.A. Reid was a good fit on the show. He brought that label seriousness to it. And I loved watching him sitting there. I don't know if you ever watched the show, but he'd sit back and every time an artist sang, he'd get this look of rapturous joy in his face like he was hearing, Enrico Caruso performing an aria. He just always was so into it. I don't know whether that's just his thing, that he's very supportive of artists and very encouraging or what, but he just looked enraptured at times. Not that he wouldn't say pointed things, but when he listened, he just was an interesting guy. I think The X Factor is really good. I think they've got a lot of commercial artists on their show. I think they're 10 times better at finding talent than The Voice. I think they've got a lot more talent than American Idol had last year. I look at their top 10 and the kids who were down towards the final three, and I just think I would book almost all of them as I would put out an album by almost any of them. There's like four acts on there that I would seriously consider backing if I had a record label. So I think that, as far as talent goes, all I need is to have one or two acts break through, and I think the viability of X Factor could increase greatly. But Simon Cowell did have he's got an emergency meeting in England in January to talk about the X Factor UK. That show's hurting because he's not there. This one is not the roaring success that he wants. You know, it's still top 15, top 10, so it's nothing to sneeze at. It's just not the blockbuster that The Voice and American Idol are. And anyway, I think he's not the best judge. I think Demi Lovato is the best other judge alongside Simon. Britney Spears is afraid to say anything. She comes up with one sentence, just like almost comically terse. She says, "I think you're really, really talented, and that was a good performance." That's all she says. I think she's afraid of sounding silly, so she just limits herself to literally one line for almost every critique. But Demi Lovato has a fun, jokey, sparring back and forth with Simon. They mock and tease each other regularly. I assume they get along, and it's all in good fun. It's very entertaining. It's very good. And she has smart, interesting things to say. So I think she's the one that you really would not want to lose.
Let me get this straight. Britney Spears, the pop singer whose biggest hit is Oops, I Did It Again, is afraid of sounding silly. Okay.
That's right. That's true.
Well, okay. It takes a nation of millions to hold them back, but only a few rock insiders to name Public Enemy to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. They join an eclectic mix that also includes progressive rock band Rush, the rocking Sisters of Heart, film composer and singer-songwriter, and by the way, no friend to short people, Randy Newman, bluesman Albert King, and the late disco diva Donna Summer. Lou Adler and Quincy Jones also will be inducted as non-performers. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
Well, it's a big deal to the bands and artists involved, obviously. It's an eclectic mix, to say the least. I don't think these people would ever be in a room together other than for the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. I'm very glad Rush is in there because progressive rock needed a standard bearer in the hall. And I'm glad it's them instead of, say, Yes or the Moody Blues or King Crimson. I'm happy to see Rush there. I love Randy Newman. He's a favorite. Donna Summer obviously should not have had to wait until she died to get into the hall. But I'm most intrigued by Lou Adler, who I was familiar with a little bit. But I looked up his life after he got into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. And he's in as a non-performer, but he's done virtually everything else. Are you familiar with him at all?
Only vaguely.
Yeah. He ran rock festivals, Monterey Pop. He owned a record label, Dunhill, which he later sold and had a lot of great artists on it. He was a producer. He oversaw everyone from Sam Cooke to Cheech and Chong. He did some of their comedy albums. He produced Carole King's Tapestry, one of the best-selling albums and certainly one of the most influential. And then when it came to movies, he did the Monterey Pop film. He did Cheech and Chong movies, and he did Rocky Horror Picture Show. And to top it off, he owns the Roxy Theater nightclub in West Hollywood. I mean, he's just
done
everything.
That's what I know him for.
He's done everything. It's kind of a crazy impresario, you know. He's the man. So as far as a guy who's been involved in every facet of the music industry, other than, I guess, getting on stage and performing himself, he doesn't get much better than Lou Adler. Quincy Jones obviously deserves to be in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. He has to be. So, you know, given the weird mix of artists that they had in their long list, it's a pretty good list.
Well, I like what Seth Meyers had to say about it on Weekend Update on Saturday Night Live this past week.
The Rock and Roll Hall of Fame announced this year's inductees, including Donna Summer, Public Enemy, and Rush. Who are those other two, said fans of any one of those?
That was good.
Yeah, I thought that was very funny.
That was good. I know you're a fan of the Rolling Stones. They're already in the hall.
Yeah, I mean, I like the Rolling Stones as much as anybody. You know, I'm not I'm not a huge fan the way I am, say, for Bruce Springsteen, as anybody who listened to last week's show knows.
Will you be looking forward to seeing them perhaps come to your area?
Well, you know, they did these shows in London and in Brooklyn, right around your neck of the woods, Michael. And of course in Newark, New Jersey. And I guess this is their comeback shows, where their 50th anniversary shows. And over the last week on their iPhone app, they listed out their upcoming tour dates, and one of them was Coachella in Indio.
Oh, well, then they're definitely going to Coachella.
Well, you know, 2 years ago, or for last year's or this year's Coachella, there was some rumor that, oh, the Rolling Stones are going to be booked. And I thought that would be the killer booking. Like, who would you hope to get for a big festival like that? And I thought, well, maybe U2. Well, they've already played, you know, a big festival. Maybe Bruce Springsteen. Well, he played Bonnaroo. And then I thought, well, I guess you'd have to go with the Rolling Stones or maybe The Who.
Oh, well, so now they're coming.
Well, it was, you know, it was up there for, you know, maybe 15 minutes to a half an hour, and then it was taken down by whoever controls the app.
So it was an early mistake. They leaked the news unintentionally.
Yes, they did.
Yeah. So that's exciting news. Are you excited? And you already have your ticket to Coachella, right?
No, I don't, actually. You know,
you're not going this year?
As I get a little older, you know, the standing in the sun on a field for 4 days or 3 days and heat and...
So you're not going this year?
I don't know. We'll see.
Isn't it already sold out?
Not yet. I think the tickets will go on sale again in January.
Well, another music news, of course, Clear Channel is one of the dominant radio owners around the country, and they've been laying off some people.
Yeah, they laid off people, I think, earlier this year or late last year, and once again, they're downsizing their radio stations as radios struggle to continue to stay in business.
Well, they already got rid of DJs, so I wonder who else they're firing.
Administrative personnel? I don't know. Well, you know who else is struggling? Sports magazines. In fact, riddle me this, Michael. If sports is the hottest, most valuable property on TV and a huge draw in person with millions of people attending professional sporting events every single week, why are magazines devoted to sports hitting hard times?
Good question.
Yeah, the venerable Sporting News is shuttering its print division to save money and hopes to stay alive as a website, an app, and 6 times a year they'll print a special edition as opposed to weekly, which is what they are now. Meanwhile, Sports Illustrated and ESPN, the magazine, have been, you know, they've seen drops in ads over the past year. And this is a quote from Steve Madden. He says, in terms of daily commentary or game stories or stats, it's all digital. And Steve Madden is a former Rodale digital exec and current general manager of Sports on Earth, which is a sports news site co-owned by USA Today and Major League Baseball Advanced Media. He went on to say, as a kid, I used to wait for sporting news every week to get statistics. Now that kind of information is being updated live. There isn't a huge need for the print property. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
Well, it's a big whoop. It's the same reflection of everywhere else in the magazine and newspaper industry. I think Steve's quote is great. Makes clear why Sporting News is out of business as far as a print edition, essentially, because the stuff that they provided is just widely available all over the place online.
Yeah.
So why would you wait to get something 8 days out of date? So it's hard to compete. You know, what they need, of course, is in-depth features and substantial writing and reporting that you can't get anywhere else. That's where Sports Illustrated and ESPN hope to survive. And that's what you see on, is it Heartland? No, it's not Heartland. It's Grantland. It's a good website that has sports and other features that are well written, but it's a hard road to hoe. You know, you can't get as good audience and can't make as much money online, but you can't make money offering up statistics, and people don't want to wait 2 or 3 weeks to get information on what sport events happen. So they're in a sort of a tough bind, but it's the same for everybody else, I guess.
Well, thanks to the FCC, TV commercials that come blaring out at you as at massively higher volume than the show you've been watching are now against the law. I was thinking of reading this one.
Yeah, you should have said, thanks to the FCC.
Yeah. Well, the Commercial Advertisement Loudness Mitigation Act, or CALM, is now in effect. The volume of TV ads must be consistent with the TV shows that are airing them. If you think an ad has broken this law, you can complain to the FCC online, at which point they will completely ignore you. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
I think it's a very big deal, Sperling. A lot of people commented about it online. They were very happy about it.
Hold on, Michael. Michael,
I
just have to turn your pot down here. Okay, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
I haven't seen this much coverage for an FCC ruling in years. People were thrilled by this.
Yeah.
I mean, I saw this on Facebook. I saw it everywhere. People were like, "Thank you, Jesus." Because it is annoying when you're watching television and you have to leap for the remote because the commercial, which I never watch anyway, but the second they come on, it's a blares out at you. It's just so annoying. So I think this is about to be the most popular thing they've done in years.
Well, apparently this was all started by a congresswoman who was, I guess, at home with her family for the holidays, or was at home with her family. And I know I'm getting this wrong, so I'm paraphrasing the story here. But she was at home, and she yelled at one of her family members to turn the TV down as soon as the commercial came on. And her family member yelled back, "You're the congresswoman. You do something about it." Well, she did.
And Arrow's done something about their bad reputation in the TV industry.
That's true. Do we want to cover this, or do we just want to move on? I mean, effectively, Aereo, which is this huge antenna, basically, it's a... I don't know, what would you call it?
it's an over-the-air service for people who want to watch TV on their iPads and tablets and phones and all that.
Right. They stream it to your computer or to a little set-top box or to your iPad. And
it's a competitor for cable and satellite, and it involves over-the-air TV channels.
Right. So you can only get over-the-air channels. You can't get, like, CNN. You couldn't get because they're not over-the-air. However, Aereo is actually going to pay to stream Bloomberg TV to you.
Because nothing says, you know, signing up new subscribers like Bloomberg. It used to be, I want my MTV. Now is it really, I want my Bloomberg cable business radio show.
Well, it just goes to show you where all the cool kids are on Wall Street.
That's right. Yeah. All the rich kids.
Yeah, that's true. Well, is it a big deal or a big whoop?
Oh, it wasn't a proper thing. I would say it's a modest big deal.
Okay.
A step in the right direction for Aereo if they want to be a genuine competitor with cable and satellite.
What was bigger than Superstorm Sandy? How about Whitney Houston and Gangnam Style? Searches for info on Houston were the biggest trending topic in 2012 on Google, followed by people looking up size goofy video. Then came Hurricane Sandy and other popular topics like the iPad 3 tablet, the video game Diablo 3, what? Kate Middleton for both naughty photos and her pregnancy, basketball player Jeremy Lin, who? No, of course, I know who he is. The question,
hey.
I know, I'm just kidding. And of course, the question, is Morgan Freeman dead? And the answer is no, he's not, by the way. Is this a big deal or a big whoop?
This is a big whoop.
Okay.
And number 12, by the way, was Showbiz Samba.
Number 12? Oh, well,
I'm just guessing.
We're going to have to move it up there to number 11 next year.
Everybody search for Showbiz Sandbox on Google.
Speaking of lists, Madonna continues her remarkable run of success. Don't call it a comeback. Her last tour was the biggest ever for a female artist, so it's no surprise to have Billboard reveal that Madonna had the highest grossing tour of 2012. She grossed $228 million, sold out all 72 shows, and had 1.6 million fans in attendance. Too bad they didn't all buy her new album, that's for sure. Now, this guy, young whippersnapper, as I like to call him, Bruce Springsteen was number two with $199 million in gross and 2.1 million tickets sold. Now, I think that's interesting that he had 2.1 million tickets sold, made less money than Madonna. Why? Her tickets are more expensive. Roger Waters, Cirque du Soleil's Michael Jackson tribute, and Coldplay rounded out the top five. Country acts and veterans dominated, but newer stars like Lady Gaga, who came in at number six and pulled in $124 million. Jason Aldean at number 13 pulled in $40 million. Lady Antebellum, Justin Bieber, and Taylor Swift also made the cut. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
It's a big deal. It shows this is where the money is in music. It's not in album sales, that's for sure. So you see someone like Taylor Swift, she's on tour, and if I walk to my Duane Reade, there's a There's a Taylor Swift section. There's like a big poster out front about go to the Taylor Swift section where they sell lipstick and makeup and there's a little Taylor Swift catalog and things. It's like, you know, these people like One Direction and Justin Bieber and Taylor Swift, they are cashing in eight ways to Sunday with everything but their album sales. You know, I mean, this is where you make money. You tour, you have all these merchandising deals, you make it quick, you make it fast. So, but touring is really the engine that drives it. But you see a lot of veteran acts and a lot of country acts, which is kind of interesting. They are really heavy and well represented in the top 25. So country fans come out to see people in concert, and veteran acts are still pulling them in. They're trying to develop new acts because you need new lifeblood to become the veteran acts of the future. Hopefully that's what Lady Gaga and Lady Antebellum and Justin Bieber and Taylor Swift will be down the road.
You know, I couldn't hear that last part because there must be a short circuit in my Dr. Dre headphones.
Exactly.
Well, if you could...
And Taylor Swift had a good week. She was number one on the Billboard album charts. Her album Red is peaking at number one again, right before the holiday selling season for gifts. And Bruno Mars, who we're both a big fan of, he's on top of the Hot 100 with Locked Out of Heaven, which was a number one hit if I'd ever heard it. So I'm glad it made it all the way to number one.
If you could start from scratch, Michael, how would you design a bookstore for the 21st century? Now, that's what the UK chain Foyles wants to know. They're redoing their flagship store on Charing Cross Road, which is in London. They've made an appeal to industry figures and customers for ideas. They'll hold a one-day workshop with the architects in February and announce the plans after that. They need to grapple with digital books, fewer sales of physical books, space for readings and events, showcasing the knowledge of booksellers and making it easy for people to buy books no matter which format they want to use, all without making the bookstore itself irrelevant. Bookstores are still the best way to discover books. At least that's what they say. even though it's the digital realm where sales are migrating, because we all go to the bookstore to find out what books we want and then go home and buy it on Amazon, right? Mm-hmm. Well, is this a smart or a desperate recognition that bookstores, they're just simply fading? And is it a big deal or a big whoop, Michael?
Well, it's a big whoop in the scheme of things. Bookstores are fading away. The big chains are not going to be around. But it is a good question. What would you want if you could redesign a bookstore from scratch? I think
maybe like a place for coffee or
right, a Starbucks. Well, that's what bookstores are right now. They're gigantic coffee store chains with a lot of free reading material on hand.
Right.
If you were going to design a bookstore that you thought might be successful, I think the essential element is that space, that stage, that theater where you can have readings and concerts, frankly, and talks and debates, and you know, make it a community center of a vibrant sort of literary culture where people can speak on the issues of the day, promote their book, read from their novel, that sort of thing. I think that is essential. You got to have it in the back. You got to have it friendly. But I think the other idea is that you've got to get away from the idea of a bookstore as a library where you walk in and there are, you know, 10,000 different titles available, because you just can't compete with online and you can't compete with eBooks. So what you need is a more curated store where everything there, or a big chunk of them, are selected and presented and chosen to say, no, here's like random 500 mystery titles, but every mystery title here, every series we have, is one we recommend or one we really love. These old books that we have on display, here's why. You've got to really make it a conversation between the store and the customer and make it as easy as possible for them to discover new books, both new releases and classic ones that you want to tout, that goes beyond what they can find on Amazon in 5 seconds.
That kind of wraps up Big Deal or Big Whoop for this week and moves us right along into Inside Baseball, where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We'll explain what they mean for the business and, more importantly, how they affect you. And this week, we're taking a look at an article in The Hollywood Reporter written by Kim Masters, and it was titled, Why Studios Don't Pay to Make Movies Anymore.
Yeah, and it was interesting. I thought, oh, that's interesting. You know, studios are sort of outsourcing their budgets and all that. It was like 7 pages long or 7 page turns. So I dove into it eagerly. Kim Masters is an excellent writer.
Yeah, she's great.
It turned out not to be really about what the headline said. It was
I thought it was going to be about financing, about film financing and about slate finance. And it wasn't about that at all.
Studios laying off the cost of movies and lowering their risk and all that. No, nothing like that at all. It's really a poll of industry insiders and a description of who thinks what studios are really focused on the business of making movies and are interested in making movies and funding them rather than just being a distributor for somebody else's risk.
Right.
So you want to make a movie, they'll be happy to distribute your film for a fee and take a cut. That's what a lot of people see in Hollywood today. So they're ranking the 6 major studios and saying who's really in the business of making movies and therefore is popular, because, you know, if you want to get a movie made, you can go to Warner Brothers and say, hey, here's my great idea. I want to back it. And they might say yes. So it was interesting. It was just a misleading headline.
Well, you know, Warner Brothers might say yes, but more often they say no. And they are really, at least according to this piece, the only studio that's still in the business of making and releasing movies.
Yeah, and I thought that was unfair, but we'll get to that. Is that your opinion of, is that your impression of Warner Brothers in the town? That people...
Well, they make the most movies, that is for sure.
Well, and if they greenlight the most and they're making them with their own money, then, or at least with a co-financed slate, then they're greenlighting the most movies, and therefore they're the most popular. Is that the idea?
Well, most popular. I mean, I don't know about most popular, but they're certainly the biggest.
The one that people think they can go to Warner Brothers and get a movie made.
Yeah, I mean, it depends on who you are, but yes, they are definitely one of the studios that you kind of say, hey, we should take this to Warner Brothers.
Because you're at the, well, you would take it to all of them, but they might be first on your list, whereas Paramount might be last on your list, because they're barely making any movies.
Yeah, that's true. Paramount, I mean, you're absolutely correct about that. Disney kind of falls in that category too, because they pretty much outsourced most of their slate to you know, the Lucasfilm and Bruckheimer.
I disagree with that, because they didn't outsource to Lucasfilm. They bought Lucasfilm. I mean, they own Pixar.
Well,
they own they own Star Wars. They're making movies with Bruckheimer. So they're making, as Alan Horn said, they are the ones bankrolling their own movies completely.
Right, right. No. I understand that. But I mean, try and bring A Ruthless People, which was made by Touchstone. Okay, so that's a Disney label, if you will. They wouldn't make that movie today.
You're talking about whether, see, that's the whole, my take on this article. This is about people who aren't at a studio and want to get a movie made, and where do they have the best shot? That's right. Not the same as saying who's actually making movies. Disney's funding movies. They're making movies. They're not laying off the risk on other people. They've got a solid, strong slate, and they've got some of the biggest properties in the world. They're just not making your movie. They're making their movies.
Yeah, darn it. Why aren't you making my movie? I want you to make my movie. I don't have one, but if I did, I'd want you to make it.
That might annoy you as an independent producer, but that's not the same thing as saying that they're out of the business, which is what Paramount sort of is. They're distributing other people's films, and they're not making anything right now, so they're hardly in the business. Next year, they're basically in the Chris Pine business.
Right.
You know, they have 10 movies coming out in all of 2013, and the two big ones are Star Trek Into Darkness, which I'm really looking forward to, and a reboot of Tom Clancy's Jack Ryan, both of which star Chris Pine. Other than that, you've got like Top Gun in 3D. That's one of their 10 films coming out. Or, you know, a reissue of Top Gun. You've got a sequel to Anchorman, which feels like it's about 10 years too late. You know, they've got 10 movies.
Movies.
So they're not in the business at all. What about Sony? They're at number two on this
list. Well, you know, their parent company, the electronics manufacturer Sony, is kind of, they've fallen on hard times. And they it's no secret that they are definitely cutting back on the number of titles they're releasing and how much money they're putting into them, not only the making of them, but the marketing. In 2002, they made and released 31 movies. 10 years later, 2012, this year, they have made 18 films.
And that's the same thing is true at Fox, where in, Disney, they had 13 films in this year, and they had 22 a decade ago.
Right. Now, they actually said, hey, we're going to be making less movies. They actually came out and said it, mm-hmm. as opposed to just quietly making fewer and fewer movies.
So the other thing that's interesting here is how many studios have a change at the head or are in turmoil. Warner Brothers just had a change in the head of the company. Universal has been shopped around in a way. They're looking for new management to take over Universal.
Right. But we all thought it was going to be, you know, Stacy Snyder from DreamWorks, and those negotiations fell apart.
Fox also had a co-chair with Tom Rothman and Jim Giannopoulos, but now Tom Rothman has left and Jim Giannopoulos is on his own. So that's sort of a change. That's three out of the six.
Yeah, true. And Alan Horn is new when you think about it.
And Warner Brothers had a change in the head still as well. Actually, that's one.
Well, they're going through that change right now.
Three, four. So that's really like four out of six practically.
Yeah.
They're changed at the top or have somebody, you know, whose job is not safe. And therefore, you know, you're at Universal. You don't feel like you can greenlight a lot of stuff because they're trying to find someone new to take over the company, to run it, you know, to be a new head honcho.
Right. I mean, I guess there are some people that would say, well, you know, being a studio isn't what it used to be.
It's better than being a podcast head.
Oh, hey, I resemble that remark.
So that's the article. It's sort of a take on who's popular, who's most likely to greenlit your independent production and get a movie made if you wanted to, who's making movies and who's laying off their wrists so much that they seem like they're barely in the business. I thought Disney should have been higher up. I thought they should have been number two, frankly.
Right, instead of Sony, which is number two right now.
I feel like Disney is making movies. They're financing them. They are active. They are producing movies for a worldwide audience. They're not just laying off risk and serving as a distributor for someone else.
Right. Well, you know who distributes our show? Showbiz Sandbox?
No.
iTunes, the Zune Marketplace, Stitcher. Actually, you can get our show just about anywhere they give away podcasts for free.
But can you get it next week?
You know, I'm thinking that probably not. Although we might have a little Christmas surprise for you next week.
Well, I wouldn't say that because I don't think your time's going to run out.
Well, we'll see.
But so we're not going to have a show on Christmas Eve. What about New Year's Eve?
We're going to try to put out a show on New Year's Eve. That's going to be our goal. We'll be drunk, but you know, we'll still
put paint on the air.
Yeah, exactly. But please do go to iTunes, the Zune Marketplace, Stitcher, again, any place podcasts are given away for free. And subscribe to the show, rate and review the show. We really appreciate it. A couple of people did so over the last week on iTunes. Although I've now been told that I guess not all of the reviews, I can't see reviews coming in from India or the UK version of Showbiz Sandbox. iTunes.
Or Bermuda.
Yeah.
I'm sure on the web.
Yes. And unfortunately, I can't read them. I know people have said, hey, I've rated and reviewed the show, and yet I don't see them on the US version. So I apologize if I'm not reading your name out, but we do appreciate it. Now, you can find ways to subscribe to us or even ways to follow us. We're on Twitter, where our username is ShowbizSandbox, and we even have a Facebook page where you can like us. Again, our username there is ShowbizSandbox. You can find that information as well as ways to contact us. Our email address is dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's D-I-R-T at showbizsandbox.com, or you can leave us a voicemail. Our number is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. It's toll free, so please feel free to call or email and give us some feedback or leave your comments. We appreciate it. Even in the comments section on our website, showbizsandbox.com. That's where I was headed with all of this. That's where you can find all of that information, as well as all of the links to stories we talked about on today's episode, showbizsandbox.com. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They can be found on MySpace or on their website, who is mgmt.com. Michael Giltz, he's got a website. And last week, who was it? Engelbert Humperdinck, I think you said, .com?
No, that's not my website. My website can be found at whythehobbitsucks.com.
I'm pretty sure that domain is already taken, maybe even by Michael, but you can find out at michaelgiltz.com, that much I know. Some of my writing can be found at celluloidjunkie.com. Until next week, or actually, until New Year's Eve, play nice.